It's 3:05. I'm tired like the rest of us. We are in committee nonstop. So by the time we get to 3 o'clock, we're starting to do a little dive. But I did have a little hit of chocolate, so I think I'm rejuvenated for at least 2 more hours. Welcome. You are in the Senate Education and Workforce Committee. We're happy to have you. This room has never been so full. And I bet you that there's a number of people here from the Oregon School Employees Association, and we're sorry. Sorry that many of us didn't get to come over to your luncheon because we had a caucus today. This time of year, it's always hard to know when that's happening. So we are glad that you've joined us this afternoon. I will let you know that I don't like cell phones going off, so if you have one, please turn it off or turn it on vibrate. If it goes off during the hearing, I'll ask you to make a contribution to the Common School Fund. And finally, we have sign-up sheets over there if you're here to testify on a bill. And then while I appreciated all the applause, we don't allow that during the hearing, so we'll be done with that for now. Welcome. And the first bill we're going to take up is Senate Bill 447, which I think is near and dear to a lot of hearts in this room. So first, I want to hear from Tricia Smith, Joanne Smith, and Merlene Martin. And we are in a public hearing on Senate Bill 447. Thank you. And Ms. Taylor is going to tell us what that bill is about while our guests are coming forward.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 447 removes individuals who are performing services in other than instructional research or principal administrative capacity at certain educational institutions from the disqualification for receipt of unemployment compensation during certain periods. This measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and you'll hear soon in testimony that we currently have the -1 amendment to the bill.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Tricia, would you like to start?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents 20,000 nearly classified and certified education professionals that work in Oregon's K-12, ESD, Head Start, community college programs, as well as libraries and parks and recreation agencies. They perform classified and certified jobs. That is everything that is non-management that goes on in the schools. My members do. And they're happy to do that. They're cooks, they're custodians, they're bus drivers, they're teachers, they're educational assistants, and they're all behind me. And they're here to see what you're going to do on Senate Bill 447. I'd like to begin by thanking you, Madam Chair, for holding a hearing on this very important bill to thousands of Oregonians. The purpose of my testimony is to describe for you what Senate Bill 447 does, and I am going to focus my attention on the first three sections of the bill, which deal with classified school employees. Mr. Wagner from AFT Oregon will be coming up later, and he will be explaining Section 4 of the bill that deals with part-time faculty in higher education. Currently, Oregon's employment statutes specifically prohibit classified school employees working in public education from receiving unemployment benefits when they are temporarily unemployed because their schools have shut down. Put it another way, school employees may not receive unemployment benefits for periods during the summer, during the winter holiday break, and during the spring break, because they know that they will be coming back to school when the new term or school year begins, and the law specifically disallows them from receiving unemployment during those periods of time. I think it's important to differentiate for you who this group of school employees is and is not. They are hourly wage workers. Many work less than 40 hours a week. Most do not work at all in the summer. Although they work by the hour rather than an annual salary like teachers and administrators, they are working in jobs that require ever more training and education in order to hold and to perform. Two examples of this are bus drivers and educational assistants. School bus drivers are required by federal and state law to successfully and periodically complete training in a number of areas, from driving the vehicle to administering first aid and medical and emergency procedures to children. They must pass medical, drug, and driving tests and hold both a commercial driver's license and now, in a bill that will come before you at some point this session, a school bus driver's license. Educational assistants provide direct instruction and assistance in a wide variety of special needs students and assist teachers in the classrooms in a number of areas. The federal No Child Left Behind Act requires 2 years of college or equivalent for these professionals, and it's expected that Congress may add similar requirements in the future for educational assistants working in special education. Depending upon the types of students they're working with, they may also be required to be successfully trained in the provision of certain medical procedures, English as a second language instruction, or other specialties. These are just two examples of the highly skilled professionals our schools rely on today to provide services and education to our students. Although classified school employees may not be the first people you think of when you think of our schools, the jobs they do are crucial to the education of our students. Senate Bill 447 provides you with the opportunity to correct an injustice that has been perpetrated against classified school employees for more than 20 years. The injustice to which I'm referring is that these workers are treated differently than virtually every other worker in Oregon. They are denied eligibility for unemployment insurance benefits when their employers close down their operations temporarily. Schools are not the only employers who regularly lay off their employees during temporary shutdown periods. Many manufacturers shut down for scheduled maintenance periods, and when that happens, their employees are eligible for unemployment insurance. Food processors shut down every year when the harvests are finished, and their employees who are laid off are eligible for unemployment insurance. This winter, notwithstanding, loggers and fishermen work seasonal jobs, and they can receive unemployment benefits during expected periods of unemployment, such as winter months. Perhaps most egregious of all to us is the situation that occurs when a school district contracts out the service previously performed in the district by our members to a private company. When that happens, school district employees who performed the work before the service was contracted out were not eligible for unemployment insurance, but the employees of the new private contractor will be eligible for unemployment insurance during the same period of time. So the same people doing substantially the same job for different employers are treated differently. Prior to 1983, classified school employees were treated just like any other worker under state and federal employment law. At that time, and for reasons I just don't know, federal law was changed to make them ineligible for benefits in the circumstances that I've described. Now, I might say here that if classified employees are laid off during the school year, or if they believe, or if their employer tells them that they will not be returning the next year, they then will be eligible for unemployment. It's only when they know that they're going to come back to work the next year that they are not eligible. In 1991, the federal law was repealed, making it permissive for states to again allow classified school employees eligibility for these benefits during layoff periods. Each session since that time, OSEA has asked the legislature to make right this wrong by returning eligibility for benefits to classified school employees. The current law is unjust in the inequity it creates between employees doing the same work under substantially different circumstances and in the substantial economic hardship it creates for thousands of dedicated Oregonians and their families simply because they've chosen to dedicate themselves to the education of our children. According to publications by the Employment Department, our unemployment insurance program is a social insurance program designed to pay benefits that provide partial replacement of wages for unemployed individuals. These benefits are meant to maintain a partial purchasing power of unemployed workers, provide a degree of income security for their families, and a level of economic stability to their communities. Provision of unemployment insurance benefits when workers are temporarily laid off also assists employers in retaining experienced workers through temporary shutdown periods. Indeed, this insurance program, which covers virtually all workers and is funded by almost all employers, exists because it has long been recognized as good public policy for workers, employers, and their communities. A recent Echo Northwest study showed that in many parts of the state, public school employers are one of the largest employers in their communities, and that school employees provide a significant contribution to local economies. Denying classified school employees access to unemployment insurance benefits when they are unemployed not only hurts these workers and their families, but the economies of their communities as well. Finally, I'd like to address the reason we have so far been unsuccessful in convincing the legislature to restore benefits to school employees. Each time this issue has been discussed, in good economic times and in bad, the reason that we're told that we can't get this bill passed is because public employers have a poor word answer. We can't afford it. Classified school employees certainly understand the fiscal situation our schools are in and the state is in today. In many cases, they have suffered the budget cuts first and worst in our schools, and now volunteer almost as much time as they get paid for. However, they also recognize that pleading poverty is an excuse that their employees have always used, regardless of their employers have always used, regardless of the fiscal situation of the state, and no other employer has the luxury of waiting until they think they can afford to pay unemployment taxes before they are required to pay them. As you consider Senate Bill 447, I hope you will look at the deeper issues we've mentioned here and listen carefully to the experiences of the citizens who are before you today. They are critical to the successful future we all want for our children, and they deserve our respect and support. Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing Senate Bill 447 and for hearing our members today.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. I have a question for you. I don't know if you're aware of my penchant for history and digging deep into files and doing research. I think it...
heard something about
that. Yeah. it's really helpful to me, and I was alarmed when I read the paragraph. And, you know, I remember we've had this issue ever since I've been in the legislature, mm-hmm. and it comes and goes. But this is the first time that it hit me in the face about the federal law. And your comment is that prior to 1983, classified school employees were treated just like any other workers. And then at that time, for the reasons I don't know, the federal law was changed to make them ineligible. I want to know why the federal law was changed, and I need to know. It just helps me process. Then Oregon followed suit, which I can understand, but then in 1991, the federal law was repealed. And I'd like to know why. What was the argument in Congress about why that law was repealed? Because I sense that the argument was that it was unfair. And so I'd like to see, can you do a little research in the congressional record?
Yes, Madam Chair, I can. At this point, what I have is mythology about why it was originally passed and no information about why it was repealed. So I will do the research and get that back to you.
Yeah, I bet you could talk to one of your congressional representatives, perhaps Darlene Hooley's office here locally, and ask them to look in the congressional record. I really would like to know what the comments were surrounding that issue, and
I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair.
It would be helpful. Thank you. Because I don't like... mythology is one thing, but having it staring at you is in front of you, the real words that were spoken are really important. Okay. We'll hear from the rest of you. You can go next.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joanne Smith. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I am an educational assistant in a regional behavior center, Harris Elementary, and an employee of Eugene School District 4J. I'm here to tell you my story about the work I do and love. I've always aspired to be a teacher, and working with children has been one of the greatest opportunities of my life. I love my job, and especially the kids. I was hired by 4J in October 1995. I'd worked in restaurants for 20 years previous, and I just could not live without insurance coverage or retirement benefits any longer. I had two young sons and was a single parent receiving no child support. I had to leave my husband when he began abusing illegal substances. The children's safety and security were all that mattered. At that point in my life, I was eligible for Section 8 housing, food stamps, and health coverage for my children, but not for myself. I was so thrilled to finally be actualizing a dream, a job working with kids. Then the reality set in. As my income increased over the years, my eligibility for the services I received from the state decreased, as they should, but I could never catch up. Every wage increase actually reduced my spending power, as the government programs were eventually eliminated by my higher wage. My first year with 4J was as a classified substitute. That was in 1995. My wage was $6.20 an hour. I also worked four nights a week in a restaurant, as I never knew when I would be called to work the next day, and I had to have my days free. I was finally hired permanently. 6 hours is about as many hours as educational assistants can get. There are very few 8-hour jobs. So I was hired permanently at 6 hours in January of 1997. I was bumped up to an hourly wage of $9.90 an hour. I loved my job working at Monroe Middle School in the Learning Center. During May of my third year at Monroe, I got a pink slip and was ripped out of my job, and it took 5 weeks for me to know whether I would have a job with the district or where, and I was placed in another school. After 3 years with 4J, I was still making $9.90 an hour because of a classified wage freeze that lasted 5 years due to the passage of Measure 5 in 1991. I ended up in the Regional Behavior Program at Harris, and this is my 6th year at Harris Elementary. After 10 years with the district, I now make $14.37 an hour. I still love what I do, and I am happy with the wage increases over the years. However, I also work 6 hours a week as a swim attendant to helping physically challenged teenagers. It is a 4J program, and I am paid my hourly wage. So after my 6 hours at Harris with the little kids, I rush to the pool to work with my other kids. I love that job. I also work for a security company, Crowd Management Services, and do events like the U of O football games and basketball games, the Junior Olympics, lots of track meets at Hayward Field, and other events in the vicinity. So I have 3 jobs. I've always worked at least 2 jobs simultaneously, and when summer comes around, I get really nervous about how I'm going to pay my bills during summer vacation. I've been fortunate enough to work summer school for the last 3 years, but it is only 4 hours a day, 4 days a week for 4 weeks. That's a lot of fours. The swim program is only during the regular school session, so I don't have that job during summer vacation. Winter break, which is 2 weeks, and spring vacation, which is 1 week, also make a huge impact on what I take home the following months. My health insurance premium is $110 a month, taken out of my check each month. Then during the last 3 paychecks of the school year, the 3 months' worth of insurance premium to cover the months that I'm not working in the summer are prorated, so $200 instead of the $110, $200 is taken out of my checks for the May, June, and July paychecks to catch up with my health insurance payments. I want you all to know that classified employees love their jobs. I love my job, and we love the kids. We are dedicated professionals and make a huge difference in the lives of the children we work with. The burdens of never making ends meet, in spite of many of us classified employees working 2 or more jobs, are overwhelming at times. The stress of looking for summer work is almost more than I can bear as I'm getting older, especially. Eligibility for unemployment insurance benefits during those breaks would so change the lives of many classified employees. Thank you for your time, and I hope you consider my testimony when you decide to vote yes on this important bill.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. We'll hear from Ms. Martin next.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Merlene Martin, and I'm here as the proud president of the Oregon School Employees Association. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify before you in support of Senate Bill 447. In my capacity as OSEA president, I travel throughout the state to many different meetings and events scheduled by our members. It is at these meetings that members often ask me questions, voice concerns, and express their opinions on issues important to education and their jobs. One question that has been raised for years by our members across the state is, why are hourly education employees employed by a school district ineligible for unemployment insurance benefits during school closures? As we have talked to legislators over the years, many have told us that it's not that they're opposed to classified school employees receiving the same insurance benefits that almost all other workers receive. It's just that school and state budgets can't manage the expense. Because there are so many workers who would qualify for this benefit if it were granted, the fiscal impact would be significant. On behalf of the workers who are in school today and unable to speak to you themselves, I would like to offer you their perspective on the cost of this issue. I believe you will hear from the Employment Department today that if you pass this bill, the fiscal impact on K-12, ESDs, and community colleges and higher education institutions will be approximately $55 million per biennium at full implementation. That is because currently our employers do not pay employment insurance taxes the way that most employers do. And I believe the fiscal impact assumes that the districts will pay the costs as the claims occur. If all the department's assumptions are correct, that will indeed be a significant fiscal impact on schools. But while you are considering that fiscal impact, I hope you will also consider its underlying assumptions as well, because they too are significant. The cost is based on the assumption that more than 12,000 claims will be filed per year. That's more than 12,000 Oregon workers who are thrown out of work every year without a safety net. That's more than 12,000 Oregon families who are suddenly without income, without any help. And that's every community in Oregon that feels the effects when a large number of their working citizens are suddenly without work or income. And that's hundreds of employers that don't have to pay the same cost for their workers as nearly every other employer does. And that's not fair either. We understand how important budget impacts are in considering issues before the legislature today. But we hope you understand the budget impacts for these thousands and thousands of families that go unnoticed each year by decision makers and employers. Not only does this unfair situation throw these workers and their families into a fiscal crisis each year, it forces them to reconsider their chosen career in educating children. When they are forced to leave, they take their experience, their training, and most importantly, they take their passion with them. That hurts our children's education. Today, OSEA members from across the state are here at the Capitol as part of our Legislative Education Day. During each legislative session, OSEA holds this event to educate our membership about the legislative process and to educate legislators about the important work OSEA members perform each and every day as part of the Education Committee. We thank the chair for giving us the opportunity to see how your committee considers issues such as ours and offer you our insights into this important bill. We know this is a difficult issue for you, and we just hope you understand how difficult it is for us. Now, I've read this wonderful produced testimony that we worked very hard on. Now I'd like to speak from the heart for just a moment. I have worked for Southland School District for 15 years. Before that, 20 years ago, I was a dental assistant in rural Northern California, not a big metropolis, that's for sure. I make less money now than I did 20 years ago as a dental assistant. When I moved to Oregon, I had the opportunity to, I didn't go right out and seek a job because we wanted to become familiar with the area, and I had the opportunity to work in my children's schools. And quite frankly, it just kind of took my heart away. Before that, I had worked in a child abuse prevention program, and the lives of those children really touched me. So I work in the schools now. I work in the in-school suspension classroom, and I work with a very important part of our society, kids that have made some very poor choices, and they may continue to go on and make poor choices. But you know what? I make a difference in their lives each and every day, and I have a passion for doing that. That passion is really, really important. But I feel like myself as a classified employee have been punished by making this choice to work with children and make a difference in the lives of those children every day, that I'm being punished and treated differently than every other worker in the state of Oregon. And I just quite frankly don't quite understand it, and I just don't think it's fair. I think that the jobs that we do, the job that I do, should be looked at proudly, and I should be, if anything, rewarded for the job that I do instead of punished. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much for your attention today.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Any comments from the committee? I was sitting here thinking about what was going on in 1983, and that was a huge recession all across the country. We had double-digit inflation. Oregon was in a fiscal crisis. And so I'm wondering if in the congressional record you're going to find some reference to that.
I don't know, Madam Chair. The chronology, thanks to the department for the chronology, by the way, the Employment Department was very helpful. It seemed to be kind of a progression, beginning with the elimination of this benefit, the eligibility for this benefit with instructors in higher education, and then it moved from there in other parts of education, but always with instructors as the target, teachers, and there was just this short period of time when classified school employees were also considered. Maybe they thought they were on annual contracts like the other people who work in schools are. Maybe they didn't realize they were hourly or something else. But I will do the research, Madam Chair, and provide you through the committee administrator with the information.
Okay, great. Well, I think we're going to hear from the Employment Department next, so maybe they can give us a little information. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
for coming up. We'll hear from Rob Wagner and Tamara Brickman and Tom Byerly.
Good afternoon.
Hi. Welcome.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Wagner. I'm the Political and Legislative Affairs Director for the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. Our members are faculty and graduate teachers at our institutions of higher education, faculty and classified employees in community colleges, as well as K-12 classified workers. A couple folks you just heard very persuasively from. In order to be sensitive to time and keep my comments, I'm just going to keep my comments really short and focused on a couple of the technical aspects of the bill, specifically the -1 amendments that you have in front of you. To provide additional context and to argue the merits of the legislation, I'll turn to a group of our faculty from our community colleges to talk about their experiences with UI. But let me just start by saying we agree wholeheartedly with the testimony you just heard regarding the need to extend UI benefits to K-12 classified employees. For us, it's a matter of equity and fairness, and it's really time to have a real discussion about the condition of public sector education employees in Oregon. Now, back to the -1 amendments. In Sections 4 and 5, we've been working with Tamara Brickman from the Employment Department for the last few days to really try to come up with language that we hope conforms with federal law. We understand we haven't heard back from the Department of Labor, and they still have a problem with the piece that talks about adjunct faculty at our institutes of higher education. I'll let Tom talk with his level of expertise on that. I will just say we do have examples of best practices regarding community colleges in states to the north and the south of us, California and Washington, where both states have part-time faculty community colleges who can draw unemployment insurance when they're looking for work during terms that they're not employed. So we have largely modeled the language in the -1 amendments on the statutory schemes in those two states, and I'll now just turn it over to the Employment Department to talk about the specifics of the amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tamara Brickman. I am the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. And we're here today to just provide you a little bit of background about the bill as written. We wanted to let you know that Section 4 of the bill does cause what's known as a federal conformity problem under the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. And we're not here to talk about the underlying policy. I've been working with Rob to try and draft language that would basically get rid of the conformity problem. But what happens in a conformity situation is that if the legislature passes a law that takes us out of conformity with federal labor law for unemployment insurance purposes, we lose our administrative grant to run the unemployment insurance program in the state of Oregon, and employers then pay the full 6.2% federal unemployment tax, for which they currently receive a 5.4% credit if the state remains in conformity. So it's a pretty big hammer by the Department of Labor to make sure that we remain in conformity.
So, Mr. Wagner, you're really wanting to help the Employment Department to fix this.
And even with these amendments, I must say that even with these amendments, we believe, because there's a severability clause within the amendments, if you look at Section 5 of the Dash 1 amendments, it basically says if any of the provisions run into conformity problems with federal law, then none of the provisions will be enacted. And so what we're currently waiting to hear from the Department of Labor on is whether or not we can add university professors, part-time university professors, to the list of instructors in the bill. There is language, as Rob mentioned, that currently is on the statute books in California and Washington that works, and it works by the employment departments, their respective employment departments. I don't know the exact names of the departments in each of those states, signing a letter of assurance with the Department of Labor that we would still apply the law as written under what's known as an unemployment insurance program letter, which is basically the effect of law coming out of the Labor Department. And I can give you a copy of the unemployment insurance program letter that dictates what states have to do on this. And just for background purposes, the provision with respect to classified staff under federal law makes it permissive to states to not provide unemployment insurance. It's not mandatory, as professors, administrators, and researchers at institutions, they are required. It's required that we deny them benefits under federal law. Classified staff is an option of the state, and so that option of the state, it has been they've been excluded from benefits since about 1983.
Ms. Brickman, can you do a survey and tell me how many states make it available to their classified?
I'd be happy to do that. I don't have that information off of the top of my head, but I'd be happy to check and see what other states provide classified employees with benefits between terms or within terms.
Okay, I think the committee would like to see that. I know I would.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Byerly?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the department. And I want to also echo Tamara's statement. We want to make it clear that the piece of this legislation relating to classified workers is a state option. We have no issue with that. Take no position on that. That's obviously a policy decision for you guys. I also want to state, I too am a history buff. I've been in the employment department a long time, and I feel like I've let you down because I think I might have the books in my office that will tell us where this legislation started.
Oh.
I think. It started in Congress in 1976 and sort of evolved in the 77th session of Congress up till 83. And in 1993, the denial for classified workers became optional for states. And so here we are. So with that, I should have thought ahead and got that for you. I apologize.
Well, that's all right, Mr. Byerly.
No, it's not. Thank you.
You could go back and present a mini thesis for us.
I would take great pleasure in that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm still reading the thesis from 1949 about the Common School Fund and how we got ripped off.
Maybe we should have coffee and talk about it.
Well, I don't drink coffee, but we could do hot chocolate.
Okay, good.
Well, thank you. I would. All the research you can give me is really going to be helpful. And, Ms. Brickman, can you provide us with the program letter also?
I will.
Out to the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to provide you with that.
Okay.
I can actually, do all of you prefer email? Because I have it in an email format so that I can just forward it over instead of having to barrage your offices with paper.
Why don't you email it to Ms. Taylor and then she'll get it to
all
of
us? I'll do that.
Because we get lots of email.
And I will also respond with the number of states that provide unemployment insurance benefits to classified workers.
Okay.
As well.
That'd be terrific. Does the committee have any other research questions they'd like to ask? All right. Great. Well, thank you, all three of you, for coming up. Mr. Wagner, you had a...
Just a very final comment before we turn it over to our community college faculty to hear from them. It's, the employment department in the state has been great in terms of their service and working really diligently to try to come up and make sure that we're complying with federal law. They're really on the ball, and I just wanted to give them their props.
I would have to agree with you. I have found them pretty good to work with, so thank you. Okay, thanks. We need to hear some people before 4 o'clock, so we're going to take some folks. Next, we're going to take Terry Bastor. I hope I pronounced that Bastor. Pastor. Like, what is Pastor? Marilyn Pitts and Beth Ann Darby. I can't read your writing. Sorry. that's all we can fit up there. Great, thank you. I don't care.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, it's Terry Pastori.
Story. Thank you.
Sounds like an I, but it's really an E. My name is Terry Pastori, and I've been an adjunct at Mount Hood Community College, Portland Community College, and Portland State University Center for Excellence in Writing for approximately 6 years. And I teach composition and literature and creative writing. And the reason I'm here today is because I strongly support Senate Bill 447, and I'm here to share my story to help illustrate the consequences of adjuncts who are not covered by unemployment insurance. And last summer, I had my courses cut, as is usual during the summer, I had thought about it and decided that I would apply in my 6 year of working, I would apply for the first time for health insurance benefits, unemployment benefits, excuse me. At the same time, my neighbor who had worked at Starbucks was let go from Starbucks, and it so happened that she applied for unemployment and I applied for unemployment at the same time. The windup was my neighbor received unemployment compensation and I did not. I was barred from receiving a benefit I had earned because I'm prohibited by the current statutes. And as a result of that, I literally almost lost my house. I looked over the abyss into financial ruin and literally almost lost everything I owned. If it were not for the help of my family and friends, I would not have made it through that summer period. When I was denied, I had the right to request a hearing, and I did. And it came to light during the hearing that it's the language in the statutes that prohibits adjunct educators from receiving unemployment. It's the idea of reasonable assurance. And as a result of that hearing and as a result of not getting unemployment benefits, I found it to be unacceptable. I am an adjunct educator. I earn a third of what my colleagues earn. I don't get health insurance benefits. I don't have job security. And on top of that, I'm expected to not be able to claim a benefit that I earned. And that's why I'm here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pastori.
I'm going to test this out. How's that? Okay, good. Excuse me. Madam Chair and committee members, I also very much appreciate the opportunity to speak before you. My name is Marilyn Pitts. I'm also from Portland, and I'm representing the Mount Hood Community College Part-Time Faculty and Tutor Association. Quick little background about myself. I've been teaching in Oregon since 1972, as the testimony will show. First 18 years in high school, and then went through a midlife crisis, as some of us do, and ended up going into community college and teaching GED classes. So since 91, I have taught at either or both, usually both, Mount Hood Community College, which is OEA affiliated, and Portland Community College, which is AFT, Oregon affiliated. At times, as you'll see in my testimony, it truly was difficult to get through it, especially I have a couple of examples in there. I'll just mention them briefly. Probably 5-6 years ago, I was preparing a science experiment for the next day, and I needed some alcohol. And the full-timer who I was working with said, "Oh, that's not a problem. It's only 65 cents." Mm-hmm. And in my head, I knew I did not have 65 cents. This is not an understatement. This is reality. And, you know, so I had to figure out a different experiment to do to get the same concept across, because I didn't have it to go out and buy that. And I don't usually share these things in a public forum, but I think this is one of those times when it's necessary maybe to do that. The second part of the second example I want to give is that for approximately 8 years until I retired with over 30 years in as a teacher a couple of years ago, but for that last 6-7 years that I was teaching, I was taking money out of my savings almost every month. Clearly, that's not what we would expect professionals with a master's degree and that many years of experience to be doing, but clearly it was the case. At present, I am president of the Mount Hood Community College Part-Time Faculty and Tutor Association, and I've served in that capacity for 7 years. This year at Mount Hood, we'll have approximately 450 part-timers over the academic year. Some of them are just there for one term. They might be in the pro-tech field, but they're just, you know, filling a certain travel or, you know, course or something like that. Others might be there for 3 to 4 terms. Terry and I are both people who've taught there, you know, for a number of years. I've taught since 1991 every term of every year since that time. Some of those 450 people are working full-time elsewhere. And so, you know, to be honest, their income from Mount Hood is extra. Some people are retired, so they have that monthly income, and the Mount Hood Community College salary is extra. And then there are those for whom that salary and the salary that they get at Clark Community College or Clackamas and Portland all together, that is their sole source of income, such as Terry was referencing. Clearly, those people who are working full-time elsewhere or are retired are not a part of this group that is in any way likely to be requesting unemployment. So we're talking about a relatively small percentage of the part-time group during summer term who, you know, may qualify and may therefore want to apply for it. In the current legislation, and in the dealings that I understand have occurred, the assumption is that summer is a break. And clearly, for part-time faculty, it is not a break. It is one of the 4 terms, and it's not just for part-time faculty. There are a lot of others who work during that time, too. But I've enclosed, if you'll look at Attachment A, an academic calendar for Mount Hood Community College, and you'll see that summer is just one of the 4 terms of the academic year. It's not a break. There are 3 scenarios that I think are most likely to occur that could cause a part-time faculty person to end up requesting unemployment benefits. One is if there are no courses to teach. Clearly, summer term, there are reductions in the number of courses offered, and personally, I feel fortunate that I have worked every one of those summers over all of those years. But, you know, it doesn't always occur, as Terry testified. Another situation is that the assigned course might be low enrolled, which could mean that below a certain number of students, the pay would be prorated. And thankfully, in our last bargaining at Mount Hood, we got some language that said, you know, if it's going to be prorated, the instructor has the right to decide whether they're going to teach it. You know, sometimes that prorated could be at 0.4 of, you know, 40% of what they would have paid. Terry's already alluded to the low amount, so, you know, that makes it even more difficult. Or the college, if it's low enrolled, could cancel the class.
Another situation is that a full-time instructor could bump a part-time instructor because perhaps the full-time instructor's class was low enrolled. So those are the three likely scenarios that could lead to it. In the statute, it does refer to reasonable assurance, and I want to briefly talk about that. Each spring, part-time faculty are sent a form to sign. And the expectation is that you must sign it by a certain date. That's the message. And the form says that we understand and agree that we have a reasonable assurance that we will have a job in the fall. The reality is that the people who sign that know that their jobs are not secure. But they choose to sign it because they, for one, and as president of a local association, I hear this a lot, they don't want to make waves. Or secondly, they think, well, if I don't sign this, then I might not get an assignment. So for those two reasons, they sign it. And I sign it, I'm afraid, I must have to admit. I think also enclosed some language from Mount Hood Community College's part-time contract that talks about the tenuousness of these positions. And you'll see, this is on page, the third page, Article 1C4. It's clearly talking about, you know, there's no guarantee of any level of employment. Article 9C talks about part-timers get assignments, but it's after full-time faculty and after retired full-time faculty. Article 9C1 talks again about no guarantee of employment. 9C2 talks about the uncertainty of any assignments being given. So clearly there is no actual reasonable assurance. And to quote Keith Heller, who's co-founder of the Washington Part-Time Faculty Association, who wrote in an October 8th article in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, when they want flexibility, colleges argue that part-time professors have no guarantee of future employment. But when they want to avoid paying unemployment benefits, they say the professors can't expect to be rehired. We're caught in a conundrum here. Mm. When you look at Attachment B, that's one of my recent pay stubs. And I've included it because I wanted to point out that Mount Hood Community College, good people through and through, but Mount Hood Community College, as of November 30th of 2004, at that point had contributed over $104 to an employer-paid benefit, okay, to an unemployment fund. My understanding is that this is they use the direct reimbursing method, and that funds are put into that money's put into that fund, and then it would directly reimburse those who qualify for unemployment. There's some other stuff that I wrote there. You can look at it later. I won't speak to it necessarily. In addition, so I guess my point is that there is money that's being contributed. It is a benefit. It's a benefit that I never had to ask for. I chose not to. I think probably I could have qualified at different times, but I never chose to ask for. But I think people should be able to actually have the benefit if it's listed as such. You may or may not be aware, so I want to let you know that community colleges, I only know for sure of two, but Portland Community College and Mount Hood Community College both have hired, at least during 2004, the Lawrence Company of Vancouver, Washington, to sit in on hearings regarding unemployment benefits for their part-time faculty during the summer months. Clearly, there's money being spent there. I don't know what amount that is, but money is being spent, and certainly from my perspective, it would be better spent to have that money available for unemployment benefits. This bill, Senate Bill 447, I think would do several things. First, fix an oversight. I do not think there was any malicious intent by whomever is responsible for writing the bill as it's written, but it does hurt part-time faculty, and we've also heard, of course, the classified people have been hurt. And so I certainly hope that that will be addressed and fixed. this bill would enable, I think it would be a relatively small percentage of part-time faculty to avail themselves of a benefit that they've already been told that they have. And as I've said already, I think there would not be necessarily a huge expense. I would be interested to see numbers on that, but I don't believe there would be. There already is money in the budget. That fund is in the budget. And I think also the bill would provide equal protection under the law per, you know, Amendment 14 of the U.S. Constitution, which I'm not a lawyer, but it's my sense that we are not being treated equally. So I do hope that you'll move Senate Bill 447 forward in this process, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would certainly be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Pitts, I have a question, and I think I know the answer to it. Are you sensing that community colleges are using more part-time faculty to help make their budgets stretch?
I can specifically speak for Mount Hood Community College because of my experience as the president there, and the answer would be absolutely yes. The number, when I first started as president, there was a firm number for full-time faculty, and that number has dropped by 10 to 15 over the last 5 to 10 years. Whereas our numbers have increased, I mentioned approximately 450 this year. 6 years ago when we were looking at bargaining, we counted the number of people and it was approximately 350 over the year. So, yeah.
Okay. And I'm sure that Ms. Pastore's testimony, her neighbor didn't have to sign a reasonable assurance letter that she was going to be rehired by Starbucks.
Right, right.
All right, thank you, Ms. Darby.
I don't, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't quite understand the $104.49 in employment. Could you go through that again, please?
Well, that's on my pay stub, and I'll give you the information I know, and if you have a question beyond that I can't answer, I'd be happy to look into that. But, you know, when I started at Mount Hood, they did not have a separate delineation of employer-paid benefits, but over the years, they wanted to let the employees know that they weren't just getting their salary. There were also some contributions being made on their behalf to various funds. So they've delineated those. And again, my understanding, and this is from she's in charge of our finances at the college related employees. She's indicated that it's the direct reimbursing method, so that money is put into a fund, is my understanding. And then when someone qualifies, money is taken directly out of that fund to reimburse those unemployment costs.
Are you eligible for those costs?
I do not believe I am. I'm retired from PERS as of 2 years ago, and I do not believe I am. I think before that, yeah, with 30 years of experience, I probably would.
Okay, I guess I would like to have some clarification of how that works, because I'm still kind of confused of who's eligible. It doesn't have to be now, but if you could give me some information, I'd appreciate it.
Happy to do that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm a government relations consultant for the Oregon Education Association, representing 45,000 school employees in the state of Oregon, including community college faculty, certified K-12 folks, and classified employees, janitors, bus drivers, librarians, instructional aides. And mostly today, I think you've heard great stories about why this is so important and so fundamental. We're constantly asking public employees to do more and more for less. Your question, Chair Walker, also would apply to school districts that are making greater use of part-time classified staff than full-time faculty, to the point of being just slightly under what's required in order to get health insurance. We have stories all over the state of folks that they're almost working to pay for their health insurance benefit. They almost have to pay the school district. And we are just asking folks to do more and more. We're taking more away. We understand these tough budget times, but we're shifting the burden to other parts of our system because these folks will no longer be able to provide services for us at this rate, and they are valuable members of our school community. And with that, I will answer any questions. I'll be happy to do what I can to provide information to Senator Morissette, but I believe that that particular fund is individual to Mount Hood Community College. It's a school project.
Well,
it's not,
I'm still interested in it.
Okay, happy to do that.
Great. Thank you all for coming out and testifying. I'm going to bring you up in threes. You might not know each other when I call your name, but you're going to get to know each other, and it's always nice to make a new friend. Nancy Fuller and Diana Mueller and Frank, oh my, your handwriting, you're with AFSCME. Ah, come on up. And then you can tell me what this handwriting says. We'll start with Mystery Frank.
Okay. My name is Frank Vehafric, V-E-H-A-F-R-I-C.
Oh, that H didn't look like an H, Mr. Vehafric.
I get scolded for that all the time.
All right, thank you. Why don't you share with us what you're here to talk about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to support Senate Bill 447, and I won't repeat the persuasive discussions that the previous supporters for that bill have made. I am on staff with AFSCME. I represent the employees of Oregon Health and Science University. There's about 4,000 classified employees in the bargaining unit I represent. I've represented these people for 6 years. Prior to that, I spent 6 years representing state corrections employees, so it was a bit of a switch when I went to OHSU. For about 4 years, the first 4 years that I represented these folks, the employment situation there was very stable, and we had very few layoffs. And about 2 years ago, in the last biennium, we encountered some budget problems. We had layoffs numbering in the hundreds of people, and at that point, much to my chagrin, I became aware of the law that prohibits some of these folks from collecting unemployment insurance. I didn't represent educational institutions prior in my labor experience, so it was new to me. Basically, the concern that I have is that we are now facing another period of budget instability. I don't pretend to have a crystal ball to know how many people could get laid off. It could be dozens. It could be hundreds. I really don't know. The reason I'm here is I'm very concerned as to what's going to happen to these folks if the fiscal year winds down in June, and July 1st, we have hundreds of people out of work and no unemployment insurance. I would like to see that remedied. The university itself is a huge concern. It's not just the medical school, the nursing school, and the dental school. It's the primate center. It's the hospital. It's the clinics. It's the neighborhood clinics. A lot of these people are the people I represent entirely are not instructors. They're classified employees. So, in brief, that's why I'm here, to support that bill and to try to give these folks the safety net that they've earned if things get tough this summer. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Halfrich. Okay, who's next?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. My name is Nancy Fuller, and I work for the Oregon State School for the Deaf. I've worked there for 20 years. When I first started there, I thought, this will just, you know, short time, I'm going to find a full-time job, something, I'll work year-round, make a little more money. I enjoyed it so much. Here I am 20 years later, I'm still there, and I love it. I'm the morning cook. I make breakfast and lunch. The kids are near and dear to my heart. I'm their mom. I'm their friend. It's a lot of fun. I hear about their problems. I hear about the fun they have. I hear about their sports, whether they won the night before or not. I've wanted to keep that job because I enjoy the kids so much, but it's getting more and more difficult with prices getting higher for everything. I'm off during the summer. I do occasionally get offered 3 weeks worth of work, doing the laundry for the school after the kids are gone, checking in all of the linens and making sure that they have fresh linens when they come back in the fall. So I'm offered 3 weeks worth of work. The rest of the summer I have off. I always hear, oh, you're so lucky you have summers off. Well, if you knew my finances, you wouldn't think I was so lucky. And my husband works construction, so luckily he's able to get 10 hours plus in during the summertime to compensate for my lack of income. When I first started for the school, I tried to collect unemployment for the first 5 years, and then, of course, I got denied and said, forget it, so I gave up. But you hear that throughout all of my coworkers, that they have tried getting unemployment. The stories that you hear through all my coworkers are it's unbelievable how they try to go out and get a job, can't get a job, nobody wants to hire you for 2.5 months. One of my coworkers now, she just took on an extra job. On Fridays, she works from 5:30 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. She drives to Dallas where she lives. She has another job there that she starts at 3 o'clock, and she works until 11 o'clock. Saturdays, she works from 6 in the morning until 6 at night. Sundays, she works from 6 in the morning till 6 at night to be able to get herself through the summer. She's putting kids through college and trying to lead, you know, a decent life with you know, costs the way they're going up. She's had to do that. So many of the people I work with, the housing they have is becoming not adequate. The cars they drive, it's very difficult because we've got to spread our salary through that we get 9 months through 12 months, and then you've got to pay for health insurance and other costs. One question I have, the Chemawa Indian School is a lot like our school. It's a residential school, and they are able to collect unemployment, which we are not. And our school, both the blind school and the deaf school, we've always wondered why they were able to collect unemployment and we were not able to. Also, my husband works construction, so when he's off in the wintertime with lack of work or the weather, he also gets unemployment. You know, he goes back to the same employer, just like I do, and he gets unemployment, but we don't. And, of course, there's always rumors. We've heard you can't get it because of this, you can't get it because of that, but nobody has the answer. And so I thank you for your time. We heard about this meeting at 1 o'clock this afternoon, so we rushed down here. We thought, you know, we wanted to make our point and ask questions and see what we could do to help our cause.
Well, thank you. I think we're going to try to get to the bottom of some of that with our research and try to get those questions answered.
Thank you very much.
We've got quite a few more people to testify, so why don't we move on?
Okay.
And would you like to?
I'm with Nancy.
Oh.
Said it all.
Okay.
Well, I only worked at
and could you state your name, please?
My name's Diana Mueller, and I've worked at the Oregon School for the Deaf for 4 years. And I'm single, head of household, 54, and it's real scary to go out and ask people for a job for 2 months, and people don't want to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to stay at the school because I love working there, and I love the kids. And like Nancy said, our kids live there. Most of them, you know, spend the night there, and that's their home during the week. And you just become their mothers. Because you're there when they wake up in the morning, you feed them all their meals, and I love that job. and really down deep I should go get another job. But I love this job. Yeah. So it sure would help if we had the year round.
Well, thank you. Thank you for what you do for our children. We appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to call up Michael Dembro and David Reeves. And I'm going to ask you to keep your testimony a little bit short. And after these two gentlemen testify, just to let you know, I'm going to hear from Chuck Bennett and Jim Green next. Okay, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today in support of Senate Bill 447. My name is Michael Dembro. I teach English at Portland Community College, which I've done for 24 years. And I'm also president of the PCC Faculty Federation, which represents about 600 full-time and 1,400 part-time employees over the course of a year. And then I'm also treasurer of AFT Oregon. You've already heard some of the difficulties faced by individuals who are trying to earn a living by teaching part-time at one of our state's colleges and universities. To answer Senator Walker's question, at my own college, we've seen an increasing reliance on part-time faculty over the last two decades. At this point, fewer than half of our courses are taught by full-time. Almost 60% of our courses now are taught by part-time faculty, and that's a flip-flop from 10 or 15 years ago. This is a result of a steady decrease in state funding, along with the steady increase in the number of students since the 90s. Most of the part-timers are individuals who are relying upon their teaching for their livelihood. The common assumption is that part-time community college faculty would be working professionals who come in to teach in areas of their technical expertise. But in fact, the great bulk of adjunct faculty in the community colleges are teaching in the basic skills and transfer areas. These people are working full-time often, but their low-paid work is spread out over several colleges, as you heard the case for Terry and for Marilyn. They're paid on a flat per-course rate, quarter by quarter, and they are part-time not by choice, but because it's cheaper for the institution. And this is a practice that has become more current in the community colleges and is spreading into the universities as well. The difficulties faced by part-time faculty include low salary, little or no access to benefits, and very limited job security. Added to that list is the fact that, unlike nearly every other class of worker, part-time faculty are barred from collecting unemployment, as you've heard, when there's no work for them during the summer, even when they have a history of teaching summer after summer after summer. Why is that? As you know, unemployment insurance is a program in which the employer pays a small amount with each paycheck into an insurance fund or in a self-support kind of risk management pool to support workers during the period in which they are out of work. These are workers who have been involuntarily let go through no fault of their own. Not surprisingly, the statutes distinguish between such workers, those who are legitimately laid off, from those who are merely on a vacation or a break. Thus, most states have provisions within their unemployment insurance statutes that are intended to bar full-time K-12 teachers from collecting unemployment during the summer break. Full-time K-12 teachers are considered to be on year-long contracts, and the summer closure does not constitute a break in their employment. As long as they have a reasonable assurance of being reemployed in the fall, these full-time employees are not eligible for unemployment compensation. This is to prevent full-time teachers from working a 10-month schedule, receiving a full salary for the year, and then requesting unemployment compensation on top of that during the summer. This makes sense. In order to prevent this, the law in Oregon explicitly bars education employees from being eligible for unemployment benefits during the summer and any other period of school closure. Unfortunately for part-time faculty, since their situation is not specifically addressed in the Oregon statutes, they are lumped together with full-timers in being excluded. So we find ourselves in situations in which part-timers with a long history of working during the summer are suddenly given fewer or no hours during the summer, as we heard from Terry. And when they file for unemployment benefits to help them to survive during this period, their claims are routinely being denied because they are education workers and it's the summer. Every appeal that I know of has been denied, and under the current statutes, they have absolutely no recourse. This is inappropriate for two reasons. First of all, in the world of higher education, particularly in the community colleges, school does not close during the summer. It is not a break time. Rather, more and more students need to attend during the summer and choose to do so. This is a function of our changing workforce and our changing student population. Most campuses offer comprehensive programs during the summer, and 90% of our summer classes are taught by part-time faculty. Many of our part-timers teach every summer and have done so for years. They very much count on this summer employment for their survival. So, using a K-12 standard for this group of employment makes no sense. Second, the reasonable assurance of reemployment that full-time faculty enjoy simply does not extend to part-time faculty, whose reemployment is highly contingent on factors out of their control. For example, budget, enrollment, the possibility of being bumped by a full-timer whose class fails to get a sufficient number of students. Yet under the current statute, all the college has to say is that they intend to offer work to the part-timer in the fall, and the part-timer is stuck without compensation for the summer, even if in the end there's no work for him or her come September. Senate Bill 447 attempts to correct this inappropriate exclusion. Our neighbors to the north and to the south have dealt with this problem through legislation and then subsequent court case, which has amended their unemployment statutes to clearly state that reasonable assurance does not apply to part-time community college faculty because of the contingent nature of the work. California exempts anyone whose work is, quote, contingent on enrollment, funding, or program changes from their excluded from the reasonable assurance process. That is, that cannot be used as a reason to deny unemployment benefits. And I've attached to my testimony a letter from the California Employment Development Department, which clarifies how field workers are supposed to interpret the appeals. Similarly, the Washington state statutes were amended in 2001 to clarify the following intent. Quote, contingent assurances of future employment are often speculative and do not rise to the level of other forms of assurance. As such, assurances conditioned on forecast enrollment, funding, or program decisions are typically not reasonable assurances of employment. And I've attached to this testimony the legislative intent behind that statute. The goal of Senate Bill 447 is to try to secure similar legislation in Oregon so that part-time faculty can receive the same level of access to this benefit as other laid-off workers. I would point out that it only applies to employees who have established a history of summer work. You might hear from the colleges that the legislature should not make this correction because it will cost the colleges money and will therefore be an unfunded mandate. However, the key word here is correction. This is not a newly mandated program, but a correction of abuses in the current program. The colleges are taking advantage of a loophole in the statute, allowing it to be used against employees for whom it was never intended. The colleges are currently profiting from this loophole with abusive effects, and that is the reason that we must close it. What we're dealing with here, especially when applied to employees who have served their institutions and their students loyally for years, is injustice, which should not continue. Ideally, the money to fund any needed correction can be taken from any eventual augmentations to the community college allocation. But if it doesn't, we'll have to find the resources within our individual college budgets. We can no longer put this on the backs of these teachers who are educating our students and our workforce, often at great personal sacrifice, and are being laid off and put in economic jeopardy against their will. Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. And thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Mr. Dunbar. I have a question for you. I agree with you about the summertime. My son was he still is a ski instructor, and he nearly flunked out his first year because he was trying to, at the University of Oregon, because he's trying to go fall, winter, spring, and winter just doesn't work when you're in a winter sport. So we talked to the academic advising office, and they said, well, why don't you go fall, spring, and summer? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that, because when I was in school, you went fall, winter, spring, and summers were off. But you're right about the changing nature of our society, and our jobs are different, our availabilities are different, and so summer's not really a time off anymore. And I think that point's well taken. Let me ask you one other question. The court cases in the North and the South, so I'm assuming Washington and California, are those lower court cases or appellate court cases?
It was actually just in California that there was an appellate case called the Cervisi decision in the late 80s.
Okay. I'd like to, if you could, get a copy, have your government relations person get me a copy of that court case. I'd like to read that.
Great. Be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Reed?
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name's David Reeves. I teach at Portland Community College. I'm a part-time or adjunct instructor. I teach English as a second language. I've been teaching at PCC for 9 years now. Every year I've taught all four terms. I don't intend to stop teaching either, but I don't think anyone ever plans on unemployment. It's supposed to be available for emergency situations. It concerns me that I would not be eligible for unemployment insurance if I were to lose a summer teaching assignment. Though I'm classified as a part-time teacher, I teach 80% of a class load of my full-time colleagues at a much lower pay rate. I'm excluded from the college's group health plans and have to pay for a private health insurance policy. I'm not eligible for any benefits. I would be a part-time teacher, but there have been all of 2 openings in the last 10 years in ESL. And Michael said over 60% of the classes at PCC are taught by part-time. In my own department in ESL, there are 5 full-time teachers and 30 part-time teachers. That's the ratio. And I'm not expecting in a fiscal year like this for any openings to be coming up. So that's why I'm a part-time teacher still. What I'd like to make clear is that I rely on teaching all 4 terms a year to earn income. The law says that summer is a vacation for me. That's not the case. Having taught continuously for the last 9 years, I'm aware there's no guarantee for my job, just like any other employee in the state of Oregon. Portland Community College has never told me that I'm assured a class each term. I sign a notification each and every term that says the college can cancel my course at any time. And if you'd like to read from this. But you can see in that notification there's no assurance, there's no guarantee that the class will go on. I'm just merely accepting that's my assignment for that term. I sign one of these each and every term. So to conclude, There is no guarantee I'm going to be teaching four terms a year. But on the other hand, I've taught that way for 9 years. Many part-time teachers have. I've felt reasonably secure enough to buy a house, to make mortgage payments, to make car payments, pay my utility and taxes just like any other worker. I don't understand why I would be denied unemployment compensation if I lost my class assignment and were looking for another job. Thank you.
Well, that's a good way to punctuate your testimony. I appreciate that. Wow, we've sort of lost members. Let me just tell you, my colleagues here on the committee it's not that they don't appreciate your testimony. At this time of year, all of us have bills up in different committees, and so we've got to run and be in several places at once. So, all right, gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I do appreciate it. And I'd like to hear from Chris Bennett and Jim Green next. And then I'm going to clean up with Ron Meek and Lori Satinspill and Lisa Zavala, because we have another bill we want to get to no later than 4:40, because this committee has to adjourn today very close to 5 o'clock. Thank you. Gentlemen.
Great. Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, we are opposed to the bill. I want to underscore our opposition is certainly not based on any suggestion on the part of school administrators that the folks you've heard from today aren't absolutely valued employees and extraordinarily important to the full education process. That's not at the base of our opposition. Madam Chair, unemployment insurance is designed to deal with unexpected job loss, but in this case, these are employees with the reasonable insurance of a return to work. They are not unemployed persons. They're folks who have a job within a couple of months at the that they have in a job category they have agreed to take, knowing full well, and it's fully explained to these employees that the job is seasonal and there is a break. Our primary concern, Madam Chair, as it's been in past sessions, is the substantial fiscal impact of the bill. The bill overall would have a $35 million fiscal impact on the general fund. Of that, 91% of it, this is this fiscal year, $31 million would be the fiscal impact on the schools on K-12. In the second biennium, the total fiscal impact, and this is from the employment department, would be $55 million. $50 million of that in that biennium would be assigned to the K-12 system. 11,000 of the 12,000 claims anticipated would be from K-12. Frankly, Madam Chair, this is just too expensive a program. It's not justified under current conditions. It certainly isn't justified given the agreement these employees come into when they take these jobs. And I certainly understand the difficulty of employment, unemployment, the need for assistance to help you with all kinds of bills. And I think the question for you as policymakers is whether or not you want to move $31 million this biennium, $55 million $50 million the next biennium out of K-12 and into unemployment insurance for employees that have agreed to take jobs that are seasonal.
Mr. Bennett, I appreciate your testimony, but I have to ask you this. When is it ever going to be the right time to do this for these employees?
Madam Chair, There is not a right time. These are employees who take these jobs, understanding their seasonal jobs. They can certainly have their pay spread over 12 months. let's just agree, these are valuable jobs. They're paid at the current value. There's substantial interest in these jobs. If folks don't like this work, they certainly have prepared themselves to go on to other jobs. But this is the job they signed up for. I think until we agree 12-month school. We're going to have bus drivers out driving 12 months. These folks have a 12-month contract with us that it would be hard to justify going to a subsidy for these employees with unemployment.
Let me ask you this question, then we'll move on to Mr. Green. We have a friend who used to work for a gravel company in Eugene, worked there about 20 years, and he got out of that business. Now he works for a school district. Every winter, he was laid off. Every single winter, he was laid off for about 2 months. And there was an expectation that he would be hired back, and he got to go down to the employment office and collect his unemployment insurance. And there was a reasonable expectation that he would get the job back. How is it different? He's a seasonal employee.
Madam Chair, I am not versed enough in employment law to take it. I've seen the same thing living up in Gates. The mills closed every winter.
Right.
Yeah, they closed for hunting season as well. They were just guaranteed they'd close down for hunting season. And certainly some of those employees would go in and collect unemployment. They'd for retooling, for saw sharpening, for all the rest of it that goes on in a mill. And I certainly understand your point. That is not what this job is. This is a different job. This is a job signed up for under these conditions. I think your question's a good one, and I hope and I will try to find an answer to your question that either way. But I'm just not familiar enough with employment law to know.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. Thank you. Mr. Green?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I would echo the comments of Mr. Bennett. We are in opposition to the bill as it currently stands. I think for the main reason, as Mr. Bennett mentioned, is the fiscal impact on schools. The Employment Department provided you information that they expect 12,100 claims. Of those, about 11,000 of those are anticipated from the K-12 school district. I think Mr. Bennett indicated for this biennium, since it's not a full biennium, should you enact this, that's about $31 million to the K-12 system in a time when we've had declining financial resources to the school districts. That's not to downplay the role that these employees play in the K-12 system. They play a vital role. We're not trying to downplay their value in our school system. But this is a huge financial hit. And, Madam Chair, you asked the question, when is it right? When the impact wouldn't have reducing programs and services to boys and girls to do this, because that is, in fact, what we would do. If you take a look at the Employment Department website, they indicate that unemployment insurance replaces part of the income when you lose when you become unemployed. These folks are not unemployed. They are given a reasonable assurance at the end of each school year that they will be hired back the next fall. If they are not hired back the next fall, they then become eligible for unemployment insurance. And school district will pay it if they're not hired back. But under this current financial situation that school districts find themselves in, we can't support the bill because of the fiscal impacts that it would have on school districts and the reduction for programs for boys and girls in our system.
I appreciate your comments. I understand your position. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. We'll see you back here in a couple minutes, I think. Finally, we've got about 6 minutes to hear from three people, Ron Meek, Lou Satinsfield, and Lisa Zavala. Mr. Meek, why don't you start?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time.
Excuse me. For the record, my name is Ron Meek, and I'm the Director of Human Resources for Chemeketa Community College here in Salem. To start off with, I'd like to say that in application, community colleges in the state of Oregon are 9-month institutions with cyclic employment cycles. In other words, the college is not fully operational during the summer or during periods between two regular terms. As such, academic year employees, as well as adjunct instructors, can reasonably expect not to be employed during those periods. Academic year employees are hired with the knowledge that there will not be work for them, as their employment is tied to 9-month faculty, whose term of annual employment begins in September of each year and ends in June the following year. Adjunct instructors are hired with the knowledge that the institution is utilizing their services to supplement the need for additional course offerings that are tied to fluctuations in enrollment, funding, and full-time faculty loads. Adjunct work was never designed to be a replacement for a full-time job. Senate Bill 447 raises a number of concerns for Oregon community colleges. As you've heard before, the state of Washington enacted similar legislation in 2001. At that time, I was the director of human resources for Skagit Valley College in Mount Vernon, Washington. The effect of the legislation was far-reaching and continues to have a large financial impact on the state. For example, in 2001, the community colleges of Spokane paid $60,000 for part-time faculty unemployment benefits. This past year, that figure had nearly quadrupled to $230,000. This does not begin to address the cost of processing the claims or the loss of funds to student and instructional programs. Colleges do not profit from paying or not paying unemployment benefits. In fact, should this measure pass, it would force reductions in student instructional programs to meet this unfunded mandate. Given that adjunct instructors are hired, knowing that in general reasonable assurance of continued employment cannot be given, to grant unemployment could be considered a gifting of public funds. Oregon community colleges want to ensure that the money we are spending is in accordance with the law and in the best interest of the communities we serve and the citizens in the state of Oregon, especially in a time of restricted resources where public agencies and institutions are struggling to meet the needs of those they serve. The community colleges of the state of Oregon urge this committee to seriously consider that granting unemployment benefits to employees that were hired knowing there was no reasonable assurance of available work does not make good financial sense for the citizens in the state of Oregon. To consider spending public dollars in this manner reflects a best practice in financial stewardship of public monies. To consider if it is in the best financial interest of the citizens in the state of Oregon to continue to expand the rights of employees that willingly and knowingly accept work that does not carry a guarantee of continued assignment. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify on behalf of the community colleges of Oregon. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Meek. We only have about 4 minutes, so I'm just going to let the testimony fly here. So go ahead to the next sentence, Bill.
Thank you. Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm Lori Satinsville, representing the Oregon Community College Association. All 17 colleges and over 330,000 Oregonians. We oppose Senate Bill 447. Ron covered it very well, and I wanted to just add one other thing. Many of our colleges, they self-fund their unemployment, so they pay, what that means is they're paying dollar for dollar. Many of them don't pay into the pool that was talked about earlier. If the colleges are required to pay unemployment for scheduled breaks, we'll be faced with further layoffs and exacerbating the problem of our financial problems already, financial situation, reducing access to students again. And we can't support a proposal that jeopardizes the students. Thank you.
I wasn't aware that you were basically self-insured that way.
Many of ours are, and I can get you exactly the numbers if you'd like.
I would like that. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Zavala?
Good afternoon. For the record, Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. Now, I'm sure what I've learned about unemployment tax I've learned in the last 3 hours in my life. Women. Swimming. I did listen to Tamara Brixen's testimony earlier, and she indicated that there will be some conformity problems with federal law as the bill is currently written. I understand, though, as well, that there's -1 amendments in an attempt to address those conformity problems. However, we're unsure as if that language will take care of that problem. And the second point, and if in the event that it does, we still have some concerns with some of the language that's used in the -1 amendments. And I will just state very briefly, the use of the term adjunct faculty in the -1 amendments is problematic to the university system, as we do not, adjunct faculty is a term of art. We do not use that term in any of our administrative rules or any of our benefit packages or any of our official documentation or our databases. So we would have to kind of look at that and see how we would how that would affect our implementation if this became law. I will wait until I have further conversations with Ms. Brickman to determine whether or not the amendments do resolve the conformity problem, and then be able to respond, hopefully. a lot of reasons better in the future on this.
All right. Well, sure. Thank you for
thank
your
you.
Honesty, and thank you for all of you coming up and testifying. Senator Morissette, you have a question?
Well, I raised a question earlier about the $104. I guess that was Mount Hood is for unemployment. Now, you mentioned that many of the colleges do provide something. Okay, so you're going to get us information on that. I imagine that's what this is part of.
Yes, Chair Walker, Senator Morissette, I will find out. Some do have a combination of self and a pool as well, and that will reflect in the information.
Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to need some time to get some research questions answered on this bill. I think it's a long way from going places, but we'll see what we can come up with in terms of getting research and getting this conformity issue resolved. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 447, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 766, and we've got 20 minutes to hear that bill. I'd like to hear from Tricia Smith and Kathy Onagowski. I hope I did that right. That's a pretty name. So come on up and tell us what this bill is all about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 766 limits the amount of salary and benefits that school districts, ESPs, or charter schools can pay an administrator at the end of their contract. I'd like to warn you that there is a blank in the bill, so if you choose to move this, you'll probably have to take care of that before it moves on.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. All right. Take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and with me today, as the chair said, is one of our members, Kathy Bonagoski, who works for the Willamette Education Service District. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 766. This bill is intended to prohibit school districts, education service districts, or public charter schools from entering into employment contracts with administrators that provide compensation at the end of the contract that is greater than a certain, this is the blank, yet to be determined, percentage of the amount paid to the administrator in the prior school year, or that provide retirement benefits that are not available to other employees in the district or the school. This bill addresses what we believe is a significant contributor to the serious credibility problem that we have with the public that endangers the very future of education. On one hand, our schools have endured millions of dollars in cuts to programs important to school children, their parents, and their communities due to the changes in our tax system over the last 15 years and the fiscal crisis of the last four. The damage done has been significant for those students who have lost the classes and staff attention that they need to succeed, perhaps irreparable. On the other hand, too many communities, even while they're in the midst of these cutbacks, have been rocked with the scandal of discovering that their school district or education service district has entered into a sweetheart deal with the superintendent or top administrators that gives them an outrageously overgenerous golden parachute when they leave employment. Two recent examples of this are the contracts between the Willamette Education Service District and its former superintendent, Skip Lieberts, and the contract between Portland Public Schools and Steve Goldschmidt, the head of their Human Resources Department. In both these cases, the excessive compensation and benefits provided to these employees was a public outrage. Mr. Liebert's efforts to enrich his contract were the subject of many news articles here in Salem for more than a year. Portland Public Schools is still trying to deal with the fallout of a contract entered into by a previous administration that may provide Mr. Goldschmidt with a severance package of $357,000. It's hard to believe that a school district would give an employee a going away gift of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars, while at the same time our children are being deprived of the quality education they've been promised, and other employees are losing wages and benefits or are not eligible for unemployment insurance when they are laid off. But unfortunately, that's too often what's happening in our school districts. I've included copies with my testimony of news stories from the Salem Statesman Journal and the Portland Oregonian that talk about the specifics of these two situations. After reading them, I'm sure you'll understand why citizens in these communities have a difficult time believing that our schools are strapped for cash.
even though you and I know that's the truth. While the news articles are very enlightening, perhaps the most telling comments are included in the letter which I have provided to you from a Salem resident named Brenda Lee Purdom. After reading about the situation at Willamette ESD, Ms. Purdom wrote her letter to the editor and asked, "Wouldn't this money have been better spent on teachers and students? Clean up the problems before asking the taxpayers for more money for schools." Ms. Purdom ends her letter by warning, "I know I won't forget this article when voting for new school board members and increasing my property taxes for schools." And that's exactly the reason Senate Bill 766 is so important. By prohibiting these exorbitant golden parachutes in administrators' employment contracts, Senate Bill 766 will bring school districts, ESDs, and charter schools in line with other governments who are already prohibited from conducting themselves in this way. Neither state agency heads nor administrators working for local governments may receive such perks, and for good reason. After struggling with this issue for several years now, the Board of Portland Public Schools recently decided that it had to take action and adopted its own version of 766. The new policy prevents districts from entering that district, Portland Public Schools, from entering into employment contracts with licensed or unlicensed administrators that, among other things, would provide compensation for work that is not performed or a severance package of more than 90 days base salary. I've included, with my testimony, the Portland Public Schools new policy and their press release discussing it. I'm sure you'll hear arguments that the legislature should not involve itself in this issue because school districts and ESDs are separate governments with their own locally elected leadership. You'll probably hear that school district boards should be able to decide for themselves how much to compensate their administrators. Generally, we agree. However, this issue of excessive employment benefits for this select group of public employees has become more and more of an untenable issue as our schools have been forced to make cut after cut to educational programs and staff. Tax dollars are precious and few and must be spent as wisely as possible if we're ever to gain enough credibility with the voters to convince them to adequately fund our schools and other vital public services. Wasting those dollars on huge benefit packages for even a few public employees is an affront that backfires in the attitudes of the public, including other public employees, who have made sacrifices and worry about making ends meet each month. The bill includes a blank space in line 7 for the percentage of annual salary and benefits that may be included as a severance package. We think Portland had the right idea when it limited this amount in its policy to the equivalent of 3 months' pay. We support including that amount in this bill. We also suggest that you might want to include, as Portland has, non-licensed administrators in the group covered by the bill. To statutorily cap benefit packages of public employees is a step OSEA would not ordinarily support. Most public employee compensation packages are developed through a public negotiating process that few can call overly generous. That is clearly not the case with this small, select group of public employees, however. These people are obviously able to provide for themselves more than their share and more than we can afford. We should put a stop to it, and Senate Bill 766 will do exactly that. Madam Chair, with your permission, Portland School Board member Julia Brim Edwards came in this afternoon and intended to testify in support of this bill, but had to leave to go back to Portland for another meeting. And she wrote out some notes for me that she asked that I would put on her behalf in the record.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. Ms. Brim Edwards, who was here earlier, would like you to know that, first of all, she's a Portland parent, she's a former chair and current member of the Portland School Board, and she is speaking for herself on this issue, not the board, when she speaks in support of Senate Bill 766. Julia spent 3 years working to reform the Portland Public Schools contracts for senior administrators. The board adopted this policy, as I mentioned earlier, to eliminate the practice of drafting contracts with golden parachutes and special perks. These contracts were not the norm. In fact, there were only a few, but those few eroded the credibility of schools and are inconsistent with the accountability level that public institutions should hold themselves to.
the bill as drafted needs some revision. She is looking at the part of it mentioning administrators and wonders if licensed and non-licensed administrators are included in that and making sure that TSPC standards are met.
That would have been one of my questions.
And we certainly are concerned about that ourselves, Madam Chair, and would like to assure that that's correct. Although generous contract buyouts, the last thing Ms. Brim Edwards says is, although generous contract buyouts are not widespread, limiting contract buyouts will add an important measure of accountability to taxpayers. And with that, I will answer questions, and Ms. Bonikowski will speak to you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Bonagofsky. I am an employee of Willamette Education Service District, president of Willamette ESD Employees Association, OSEA Chapter 95, and I am a taxpayer. I am here today in support of Senate Bill 766. As you are aware, the voters of the state of Oregon have declined to support any new or increased tax revenues in support of education funding. I think the reason for this is simple. The public sees the likes of Skip Lieberts being given a luxury SUV at a pittance of the Blue Book price, Steve Goldschmidt's severance package of $357,000, and Salem Kaiser School District's board granting an across-the-board 8% increase for all administrators in the district without justification. Based on the actions of a few, the public has been left with the opinion that the coffers are overflowing and there is no need for additional funding. The message from taxpayers is make do with what you have. And we know that that's not the case, that we do need a higher tax base and are not able to get that now. I resent being told I have to take a day off without pay and then hear that the school board has sweetened a deal for an administrator. While administrators often are afforded equipment such as computers, cars, and cell phones charged to the budget, I, as a direct line service provider, cannot even get reimbursed for a parking meter charge incurred while doing my job. I get mileage reimbursement. I cannot be charged for parking in that space, even though it was the only one available. My superintendent was given a luxury SUV to drive, while I must drive my personal car when I'm working. I get mileage reimbursement at the current IRS rate. No administrator should get a car or car allowance when I have to provide a car I paid for with my wages to do their work. Most frustrating of all is that I am told one thing only to find out something else has happened behind closed doors in timelines that are difficult to contest, even if there was public knowledge of the deal. For example, Mr. Lieberts penned a deal for his SUV to be given to him upon retirement. He then declined the gift after outrage from his staff and the public. But in the end, instead of Mr. Lieberts keeping his word and declining the SUV gift, the deal-making moved behind closed doors and happened as privately and swiftly as possible in order to avoid public input. It happened 3 days before his retirement, and we were not informed until after the deal was done. At the same time all of this was happening, our employees were trying to get a contract that provided wages that would be high enough so that none of our employees would have to continue to use public housing or public food or housing subsidies. The contrast between the contract Mr. Lieberts negotiated for himself and the contract he agreed to for his employees is so great as to be offensive. Boards should not have special rights to grant extravagant deals to administrators. Administrators should only be allowed the same benefits as other employees. And ever the pessimist, I have to tell you this, that ultimately one positive thing that happened as a result of Mr. Lieberts' greed was in the midst of cutting programs and laying off staff, lining his own pockets, he made my job as union president easier. Because of his greed, employees of the Willamette ESD united in an unprecedented show of support to work toward a contract that supported a living wage to all employees. However, we still have a ways to go. Mr. Lieberts, nonetheless, is to be thanked for uniting working class folks at ESD, at Willamette ESD. Senate Bill 766 is a way to begin regaining the trust of Oregon voters and taxpayers. By supporting and ultimately passing Senate Bill 766, you will demonstrate that you are actively examining and repairing loopholes in the fiscal fabric of education funding. It's time to get back to the real purposes of public education, not lining the pockets of administrators with sweet deals that are above and beyond typical benefit packages available to public sector employees. Senate Bill 766 is a good idea, and it's the first step in restoring public faith in the government of this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonikowski. I appreciate your testimony. We don't have a lot of time for questions today because we need to move on. But, Ms. Smith, I just want you to research this one question. It's not as much research as going into the congressional record. But do you intend to prohibit annuity contributions in superintendent contracts with this bill? And the reason I ask that is many school districts pay annuity contributions in the superintendent contracts for tax reasons. And so paying a salary equivalent would be more expensive for some of the districts, possibly. So,
Madam Chair, we don't have a firm opinion about that question.
Okay.
Our main interest with this bill is to put a cap on the, to give a universe in which to negotiate. It doesn't go beyond a certain range. Our interest is not to make it impossible for school districts to negotiate reasonable contracts with their administrators, only to make it impossible for them to negotiate contracts
Greedy
that are not
contract.
Unreasonable, that are not reasonable.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Mary Nolan is here. We'll hear from her, and then John Marshall and Chuck Bennett can follow, and we do need to wrap up by 5 after 5. I'm pushing it today with my obligations. Thank you.
In that light, Madam Chair, thank you. I will not take much of the committee's time. I am not here to criticize any board decisions or any particular contracts, but rather to commend this committee for taking up this issue. And given that the school district in the legislative district that I represent has grappled with this very issue over some time, as you heard, and has come up with a district-wide policy that balances the interests of transparency for the public so that they know what their tax dollars are being used for, with the very real need that school boards have of recruiting top talent. I would commend that particular policy to you as a framework for moving this bill forward. And if there is some value that I can offer as you go through that, I'd be happy to work with you on that effort.
Thank you. Representative Nolan, did you announce who you were for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mary Nolan. I represent Southwest Portland in the House.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We will be calling on you later. I actually do want to have some more conversations about this, so thank
Great.
You.
Thanks for your interest. I appreciate your time.
Okay, now we have the naysayers, John Marshall and Chuck Bennett. I do like it when you come in here in support of bills.
I know.
It does happen.
It's a disappointment when these kind of get heard.
I know.
Can you go first?
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. A couple comments about Senate Bill 766 and our concerns with it. First, I would in no way want to defend the actions that you heard from the folks that testified previously. I think none of these circumstances help the public perception of schools and the fact that we believe we are, in fact, good stewards of the public funds. But I'm afraid that Senate Bill 766, in an attempt to try to prevent those kinds of things from happening in the future, may have a significant number of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. The School Boards Association does probably 75% of superintendent searches in the state, that is, helping school districts hire their chief executive officers. What was once a pool of 20 or 30 individuals that were applying for school district superintendencies, now in most cases there's less than a dozen, and in smaller school districts even fewer than that. Certainly the national attention Oregon school funding circumstance has gotten has contributed to that. Folks just don't seem to want to come to Oregon anymore. The average tenure of a school superintendent is 3 to 5 years. It's a very challenging position, and oftentimes individuals that may be a principal or a teacher simply don't want to take on the role of a school district superintendent. And we're also competing with other Western states. One only has to read the press to know that California actively comes to Oregon to recruit teachers that are in shortage there, as well as administrators. So Oregon has to be competitive with other states in terms of a salary and benefit package for both its superintendents and its administrators. The superintendent's contract, that is a contract that a school district enters into with its chief executive officer, is a public document. It is adopted in an open meeting, and the components of that contract, the provisions of that contract, and the accountability for those provisions certainly rest with the locally elected school board. And the question I think that we should all have with the circumstances, those two particular circumstances that were described, was where does the accountability rest, and why did those boards enter into those kinds of contracts, knowing that there would be a significant financial liability coming out the other end. To a couple provisions of Senate Bill 6766 that concerns us. The first, in line 6, the bill talks about salaries and benefits at the end of a contract. I'm aware of, other than perhaps the one that was described for the Willamette ESD, I'm aware of no other school district superintendent's contract with a bump at the end. Generally, the contract's for 3 years with a relatively set amount of salaries and benefit package that doesn't necessarily have that bump. Now, obviously, if the superintendent is terminated without cause, he or she has an avenue for redress by either forcing the school districts to buy out the remainder of that contract or taking the school district or school board to court. There's also, you mentioned this, Madam Chair, about retirement benefits. The bill clearly says that we cannot enter into a contract for an administrator that has retirement benefits that are not available to other employees of the school district. Oftentimes, when we're trying to attract and retain superintendents from out of state that come here and they may not be vested in the Oregon retirement system, they'll want, as part of their salary and benefit package, contributions made to a tax-sheltered annuity, a 403B. On their behalf, and that's often the case with a superintendent's contract. And finally, a concern with just the overall structure of the bill. This is not does not amend a particular section of Oregon statute. It's a session law. So the bill refers to administrator, yet in two other sections of the statute, both administrator and superintendent are specifically defined. I don't believe that the Portland School District situation, and Mr. Goldschmidt was mentioned, I don't believe that he would fall under the definition or lack thereof in this bill as an administrator. It would seem to me that would this bill pass, a school district took action, this language was ever questioned, they would look at existing definitions in statute which define administrator. And it says a teacher, the majority of whose employed time is devoted to services as a supervisor, principal, vice principal, or director of a department, is the statutory definition of administrator. Now, I believe, and I would certainly be willing to stand to be corrected, that the Portland circumstance, that was a personal services contract, and that individual did not fall under the statutory definition of either superintendent or administrator. So I think you should be aware of the differences in those definitions in the statute, and should you wish to proceed with Senate Bill 766, which frankly we hope you won't, that you would certainly clarify that. Portland is to be congratulated for adopting a policy. Many school districts have policies in place that dictate the terms of contracts, not necessarily for the superintendent, but for their principals. And principals, by the way, are under contracts, individual contracts, as well as their teachers, by the way. So, again, I think the attempting to try to remedy two very what I would say are unfortunate circumstances with a bill to try to create a one-size-fits-all approach to 198 school districts is frankly, Madam Chair and members, ill-advised. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, this is a case where the exception is trying to become the rule. And I think it's unfortunate. This has been an attempt to try to paint an entire group very broad brush that just doesn't apply. And let me give you examples. Nancy Golden, Jeremy Lyons, George Russell, Jerry Colonna. I mean, we can run down lists of administrators, superintendents in this state who, frankly, probably wouldn't be in the districts they are currently serving in if this bill were in effect, particularly the portion of the bill in Section 1, Sub 2, dealing with retirement. As I want to associate with all the comments John has made, I think he has summed up the issue tremendously, but the bottom line policy problem in this state is not this issue. This is not the issue. The issue relative to administrators is we have a shortage, that we're seeing situations where superintendencies are attracting 3, 4, 5, maybe 10, if you're lucky, applicants for them. And you may have, out of 10, 3 or 4 that are qualified to be reviewed. What that means, and certainly getting people to take a look at becoming a superintendent or administrator in this state from out of state, becomes increasingly difficult as our economic woes are broadcast out through the media and also cartoons and the rest of it. But that is the real fundamental question. Whether or not a teacher wants to leave a job and take about a 0.06%, a substantial percentage cut, to become a middle school assistant principal, because that's what the national average is. A teacher takes a cut to become an administrator. A teacher takes a cut to become a senior high school assistant principal. Not until you become an elementary principal do you make about 4% higher. Excuse me, about 4% higher than the average teacher makes. And that's the kind of problem we're facing as we begin to develop administrators. You pass a bill like this, and what we're going to have to do is begin to count on developing administrators inside the state. We don't have the structure in place to accomplish that. This is a bill, I think, desperately looking for a problem. The example of Skip Liepert, who in our reading of this bill would not be covered by it. Skip Liepert certainly made news, and not positive news here in Salem. But this bill doesn't cover Skip Liepert's situation with an SUV. That is not in this bill. The same thing, I think, in looking at the definition of administrator and whether or not it would cover Steve Goldschmidt. The kind of people who would be negatively affected or who we would scare away or chase away are the Nancy Goldens, Jeremy Lyons, Jerry Colonna, George Russell. You can run down the list, Charles Hellman, you can run down the list of really outstanding administrators in this state that we are able to contract with because we're able to offer certain kinds of benefits. And it's not luxury SUVs, and it's not $350,000 buyouts. That is, in a way, it's insulting to these fine administrators around the state. That is not the right example. That is not what's going on out there. And when it did go on out there, Portland corrected it. Portland, by itself, figured out what a dumb idea that was and corrected it. They didn't need anyone else's help. And I'm sure in the case of Mr. Liepert's SUV that when Maureen Casey, the current superintendent, leaves, she'll drive away in her own car. That won't happen again. This bill won't affect either of those. Both of those have been taken care of. And it's unfortunate to try to link those two examples somehow to what happened with measures, tax measures last election. I think all of us know that's just flat-out nonsense.
Well, I don't know that I would ever presume to know what the voter thinks when they pass or don't pass a tax measure. So.
Certainly, Madam Chair, but when you ask them to raise their taxes, they seem to be saying no. They don't seem to be saying no to Skip Liepert, sir. Mr. Goldschmidt.
All right. Senator Morsen.
Is there any way that we can track the lobby salaries that school districts and the associations pay? I mean, that's...
I think it's all public record over at the...
I think I'll do an amendment.
I'm sure the School Employees Association would help you, Senator.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, I appreciate it. I appreciate everyone coming today. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 766. And, colleagues, I want to remind you that Wednesday we are meeting from 1 to 2 to punch out some bills that we think we can get out pretty quickly, because Senator Starr and I are on our way to Pendleton that afternoon for a Judiciary Committee meeting the next morning. So with that, I am calling it a day. We're adjourned.